Welcome to the 262nd episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Karen Hugg, author of the new novel, The Forgetting Flower. Stay tuned for the interview. This episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast is brought to you by Libro.fm. Libro.fm is the first and only company which lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Support your favorite local bookstore, and you can pick from more than 125,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers. You'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know who I'm talking about, but you'll be part of a different story, one that supports your local bookstore. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out the recommendations and curated list from the people who know audiobooks best, your local bookseller. There's a special offer now for Reading and Writing Podcast listeners. Get three audiobooks for the price of one, $14.99, with your first month of membership. Just use the code RWPODCAST. Again, that's Libro.fm, purchasing audiobooks from your local bookstore, and use the code RWPODCAST. Welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Karen Hugg, author of the new novel, The Forgetting Flower. Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Jeff.
Can you read a few pages from your novel, The Forgetting Flower?
Sure. I'll read from chapter one.
Great.
Renia doubted her sister would answer, but every week she called anyway. That Friday, as the clerk packed up the plants, she stood at the wholesale counter waiting through the rings. One, two, three. By four, she knew chances were slim. When the voicemail clicked on, she knew nothing had changed in 8 months. At the tone, she said warmly in Polish, "Steady, the fall perennials are in. New cultivars you'd find interesting. And the city, it's hot, but beautiful. The flowers in the squares have such bold colors. There's even a palm tree. So if you'd like to visit, please visit. Come, let's talk things out, okay?" She ended the call and headed to the metro, carrying her heavy crate of mums. She went down the stairs into the dim subway, smelling the stale air, ripe with dried urine and rotting food, telling herself Estera hadn't meant what she'd said. Never was a long time. Still, Renia couldn't escape the ache in her chest, so as she sat on the train, she focused on the little perennials she'd purchased. 10 Misty Secrets, 4 Javelins, 6 Ruby Gems. They were lovely chrysanthemums in fresh bloom without dry leaves or disease. They had been arranged in neat rows with newspaper in between to prevent tipping and keep the soil secure. Their tidy cheeriness gave her relief from the untidy aspects of her own life. As she came out of the Saint-Germain-des-Prés station, she vowed to leave her longing behind and enjoy the summer day, the ornate buildings, cobbled sidewalks, the welcoming shade of a tree. At the cafe, a young couple read a book together as they ate lunch. Three businessmen climbed into a taxi, laughing about a missed flight. A grocer helped an elderly woman untangle her dog from a post. The scenes lightened her spirit, though she couldn't fully relax, couldn't fully exhale, not yet, but at least she lived in Paris. She was about to cross the street and go into her plant shop when she noticed a dark spill on a building wall. Paint had rolled down the limestone in streaks, tarnishing the facade. Such a strange color, not bright like the Polish flag or carmine like military coats, but scarlet like the Cordilla cherry she ate as a girl in Krakow. She paused, shifted her crate, and touched the liquid, rolling it between her fingers. It was thin, with a weak metallic scent. Looking up, she saw it had spilled from a deuxième étage apartment. The balcony door was open and a Rachmaninoff concerto stormed in the air. Through an iron railing, orange petunias jittered in the wind. That was Alain's apartment. Odd. He never opened his balcony door. She called his name, set a hand on her forehead to block the sun, waiting for him to come outside and apologize for knocking over a can of paint, laugh off some clumsy thing he'd done, but he didn't. Instead, the trumpets blared, the piano banged, the violin swooned over rolling timpani. It was as if the music answered in a language she couldn't understand. "Alain, it's Renia." No response. A rising panic swelled inside. Last month he'd had that relapse, and he'd switched medications. He had wanted a natural cure. He'd tried St. John's Wort and saffron and who knew what, but Renia knew there was no magic cure. Sometimes one simply had to change their attitude. She had, more or less. He'd wanted what was hidden in the atrium, and she'd helped him with it before, but she wasn't a doctor, and his condition was too serious for amateurs, and, oh, Lord, was it still there? "Alain, come to the door, please." The blue sky sat like a giant shroud. The concerto roared, the number two, his favorite. The liquid streaks, so scarlet red. He couldn't have done it. He couldn't. But he might have. She strained to see through the balcony railing. There seemed to be a hand with fingers, an arm stretched out on the cement floor. Difficult to... What was that, an arm? Yes, it was an arm. Oh, hell. She turned and darted to the street, paused for a scooter to whiz by, and hurried to the door of Le Sanctuaire. She fumbled in her bag for the key to the shop, and after a moment dropped the crate to better search. With dirt at her feet, she found it and stuck the antique trinket in the hole, jiggling while pulling the door in a stiff hold. Finally, the lock opened, and she raced around the counter to her phone by the computer. She dialed 112 and waited. The fountain at the room's center, a bowl with a goddess in her urn, trickled water like a pep talk. When the dispatcher answered, she explained that her neighbor, who lived at 35 Rue Serene, was bleeding and needed emergency care. The dispatcher asked questions about location and her name, but when the dispatcher asked how the man had been injured, Renia went mute, staring at the phone, unable to speak. How had he been injured? Renia knew how. At least she thought she did, but how to explain it, and did she want to? The goddess of the fountain stared with graceful ease as she poured her steady waterfall. Renia decided she better not, because after all, she didn't know how or what had happened exactly, whether he'd gone mad or fallen asleep or done the one thing he'd agreed not to do. No, she didn't know how he'd injured himself, but she had an idea. "Please come," she said. "There's blood."
Great. Well, if someone listening hasn't heard about your novel, The Forgetting Flower, yet, how would you describe it?
Well, what I usually tell people is it's a literary thriller about a woman who hides a dangerous plant in Paris, and she gets mixed up with mobsters who want to sell the flowers on the black market. So that's the sort of short summary, but it's also about her and her sister and why she and her sister haven't spoken in 8 months, and how she came to inherit this plant that releases a scent that makes a person who inhales the scent forget the last thing they thought of.
And so do you remember the original idea that led you to writing The Forgetting Flower?
Well, I have worked as a professional gardener for some 15 years, and I was always advising clients about what plants to plant for fragrance. So, you know, what shrubs or flowers had a spicy scent, a woody scent, a sweet scent, a smoky scent, etc. And I started thinking about what would happen if a plant grew that had a scent that you couldn't inhale, that was dangerous to inhale. Not necessarily foul, like the corpse plant, but actually dangerous. And how would that happen? And how would it come into being in the world? You know, who would grow that? And who would take care of it? And so that was sort of the seed of the idea. Yeah.
And so when you were working as a gardener and a horticulturalist, were you writing fiction at the time? Were you thinking of ideas?
No, I actually wasn't. I was writing for, you know, local gardening newspapers and websites and things like that. And I was doing more how-to articles and that type of thing about plants. And it's funny because at the time, I didn't think plants were something valid to write about in fiction, because I think that because they brought me such relaxation and pleasure, and they're so pretty, that I just kind of thought, well, this isn't very interesting for a fictional, you know, premise or setting. And then I finally realized, well, why do you keep going back to them? Why have you devoted your life to them? There must be something deeper. They must have a deeper allure. And what is that allure? And once I realized that there could be danger, there could be a thrilling sort of story that involved plants, that's when I really started exploding with ideas and started writing this novel. And another novel too at the time. So it was like I finally allowed my passion to come into my fiction. And once I allowed that passion to seep into fiction, then the world sort of, you know, meshed. And I've been writing stories inspired by plants ever since.
And so was there a point where you moved into fiction from nonfiction? What prompted that?
Well, I'd always written stories as a child, and before I guess I seriously moved into fiction, I had been working as an editor in high tech, and I found myself really drained and far away from writing fiction, and sort of yearned to get back there, and had always loved reading books and stories and that type of thing. But I think that I started kind of moving back into fiction once I left the high-tech world and started working with plants. That seemed more of a writing story seemed sort of therapeutic and relaxing to me. So I ended up going to for my MFA too, because after I left the high-tech world, I went to horticulture school, became a garden designer, opened my own business. But in winter, you know, there's not much work. And so that's when I really started writing. And then I ended up going for my MFA and sort of kind of jumping headlong into it.
Gotcha. And so what kind of research did you do for writing your novel?
Well, to be honest, I didn't do that much. Because it is centered on a plant. The story is sort of centered on a plant called the violet smoke. I already knew a lot about plants and botany and how, you know, what plants liked and how woody plants grow versus herbaceous plants. And really, it was a matter of dreaming up a plant that couldn't exist. And so I used an African violet, which I have sort of this mild obsession with, as the base plant for the imagined plant in the book, the speculative plant, I call it. And an African violet is not really a woody plant, but what if it were? And so that was sort of the speculative element that I took to it. And what if it had a scent? Because plants have scents to attract pollinators, but African violets grow asexually, so they just put out little pups underneath. So that's another thing that doesn't make sense botanically about this plant. So I guess I just drew on my experience to create an anomaly. And that's also part of the book, is Renya doesn't know exactly what the plant is botanically and how dangerous it is. And so she seeks out a botanist from the local university to help her solve that part of the puzzle.
And so what was your writing process like for The Forgetting Flower? Did you outline the novel or write it more organically?
I did outline it. Because I'm a garden designer, I'm very, I work in terms of the whole picture. I like to see the cohesive whole picture before I start. And so first I created this character of Renya. I thought about the plant. I thought about, you know, what if the plant was taken care of by someone who didn't really want the plant in the first place, which is her situation. But she's caring for it as a promise to her sister. And so she kind of grew out of that. Her sister grew out of that. And once I had the characters, and I knew that they're, you know, really ultimately the book is about Renya coming to Paris to seek a better life. And so that better life, the old life she has that's not so great happened in Poland. She's from a working class background, much in a tougher area of Krakow. And so that created a whole nother level of the book. What if the people from her past were pursuing her in some way? So once I had sort of the characters from her past, the characters of her present, I knew that there would be a conflict there. And so I also thought, well, if you have this plant that can erase a memory, that would be quite in demand. I mean, either for altruistic reasons or nefarious reasons, because, of course, people would like to maybe forget trauma, or maybe some less upstanding people would like to trick other people. Like if you owed someone a debt, maybe you would use the plant to kind of erase that memory from their brain so that they wouldn't remember that you owe them money. So then I plotted out the scenes in sort of a logical order. I just sort of went straight for a, if this happened, then this must happen. And if that happened, then this might happen. And if that happened, this might happen. So it was really a series of if-then statements in the beginning. And also, I knew I wanted to tell the story of her and her sister's estrangement in a parallel way as the book went on. So as the book moves in the present, it also moves forward in the past until those two stories meet at the end, at the climax of the book.
Great. Well, are you planning more horticultural thrillers?
I am. In fact, I've already written the follow-up book to this one. It's called Harvesting the Sky, and it focuses on a botanist named Andre, who appears in this book. He's a character that Renya calls to help her determine the origins of the plant. And so the second book focuses on Andre discovering a rare medicinal white apple in Kazakhstan and bringing that sapling and grafting more plants and growing those trees in Paris. But someone keeps trying to break into and vandalize his greenhouse, and he can't figure out why. And so that story kind of launches from a point of the plant being a sport of another plant, a discovery rather than a hybrid, a man-made hybrid. And it's kind of interesting because Kazakhstan is the birthplace of the apple tree. That's what botanists think anyway. And so if you go to Kazakhstan, there are vast forests of apple trees that have all come up from other mother plants. So they send out roots, they send up shoots, and those shoots turn into another tree. And then those roots send out more shoots and turn into another tree. And there's vast variations in these forests of apple trees. And so that really captured my imagination for the second book.
That sounds really interesting. It prompts me to mention, not because I'm bragging or anything, but I think it would be of interest to you. I interviewed on this podcast, and I actually don't know off the top of my head. You'd have to go back and look in the archives. It was probably 7 or 8 or maybe 10 episodes ago, a writer, Jonathan Drury, and he wrote a nonfiction book called Around the World in 80 Trees. That I think you would be really interested in. And he basically does all of this research and writes about 80 different trees, and it's, you know, a lot of historical detail as well. So anyway,
that
would be of interest. So I noticed that you're an active blogger at your website, KarenHugg.com. How does blogging fit into your overall writing?
Well, blogging is kind of where I talk with readers. And I've found that a lot of people are interested in France and Paris. And I know a little something about that. I lived there briefly when I was a high-tech editor. And Paris is one of my passions, and that's why I set this book there. I found that people are interested in hearing about Paris and some of, you know, occasionally I'll write about a garden I know about, that type of thing. And I also write about books and review other people's books who I admire and have enjoyed, and occasionally have little author interviews myself. And then I also have things for writers on the blog about, you know, just outlining discoveries I've made about my author journey and just in terms of the writing process, the creative process, getting organized, getting your blog going, what I've learned about NaNoWriMo, what I've learned about creating an author brand, and that type of thing. So I have my blog is sort of broken up into for readers, for writers, for people who are interested in plants, for people who are interested in France and Paris. and that's kind of in a nutshell who I am. So that's kind of, I guess, the blog is sort of like the different sides of me that I share with people.
Sure. So what advice do you have for aspiring writers who may be starting to write their own stories or novels?
Yeah. Well, you know, writing is a long road. I guess I would say that first. But, you know, I guess most people come to writing fiction anyway, as sort of an escape or a, you know, just sort of a relaxing hobby. And I encourage people to hang on to that, the aspect that they love about it, where you get to dream inside of a different world. And that to me is what's most pleasurable about writing. That's why I wrote this. That's why I set this novel in France, because I thought, well, if I'm going to think about this thing for years, I want to think about the places that I love. And so, excuse me, that's why I set it in Paris, because there is no other city that I'd rather think about over and over again than that city. I encourage people to take their passions and put those on the page, because when people, you know, see that, that comes through for readers. When you put your loves and what you have your deepest feelings about on the page, that shines through, and that's what really makes your prose special. I would also say that that writers should just keep revising. I mean, to me, there's a lot of talk about like, oh, I wrote 3,000 words today or whatever, which is great. But I think that the quality of those words is paramount. And revising is so critical to that, to make all the sentences sing, for every word to count. And just when you think you've done it enough, you have to go back and do it again. You know, like I doubt myself a lot in terms of how good it is. Is it good enough? You know, and I think that drive will help a writer achieve quality. So I guess those are the first thoughts that come to mind.
Sure. So what books, fiction or nonfiction, have you read recently that made an impression on you and that you would recommend?
Oh, wow. Well, right now, I'm reading the Sue Burke's Interference, which is a science fiction book, which features a plant that is sentient. So the plant narrates sections of her books. And if you are interested in that type of thing, if you're interested in plants and sort of their own lives, I guess, for lack of a better word, or what their perspective might be on the world, read her books. Her first book, Semiosis, is really steeped in that. You learn about this stand of bamboo and how sophisticated it's become because it's been around for so long that it has evolved a kind of nerve center, a kind of brain. And so that her work I find fascinating for that reason. And then, you know, I would say I love Jeff Vandermeer's work, Annihilation, which is about a section of Florida that has mutated, maybe because of government meddling. You're not sure. And a team of scientists go in to explore what happened there. And there may or may not be a creature that is created from fungus and plant-like material that has changed things there, which I find super interesting as well. And then in terms of crime fiction, which is more about what this book, I would say my books are aligned with, I love Tana French in general and just about anything she writes. Just her ability to spin the world, to create the dream for readers is unmatched. And she does it while putting in emotion, and emotion is so difficult to get on the page, that I admire her ability to, just paint the world for me while creating these characters that seem so alive. So I guess recently, I mean, I would say those three writers have been influencing me for years, and I guess just recently as well. So
great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Karen Hugg, author of the new novel, The Forgetting Flower. The book is in bookstores now, so go grab a copy or download the ebook. And Karen, thanks for doing this interview.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I enjoyed it.
Great.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money.